Welcome to the Admin Happen podcast, the podcast for people working in the real world of IT. If you're a sysadmin, working on the help desk, a network engineer, an IT consultant, a computer tech, you want to know more about servers, or even if you want to get a job in the IT field, this podcast is for you. Hi, I'm Al.
And I'm Andy. Welcome to episode 7 of the Admin Happen podcast. Now, in this episode, we're doing something a little bit different. Now, earlier on in the week, Al managed to get a phone interview, I think it was a Google Hangout, with another Al. Now, in this little interview, they talk about Office 365 and various other topics. It's a great listen, so let's go and check it out.
Right. We've got Al on the other... Well, we're having a bit of a Google Hangout this evening. We know each other through kind of the tech circles, through the Podnuts network, and Al was one of the first person who contacted me regarding when I was actually starting a podcast. So we've kept in contact, and he wanted some advice on the kind of email servers and Office 365. So we'd have a bit of a chat, and then have it on the show. So how are you doing there, Al?
Yeah, not too bad. It's a bit strange being two Al's, but hey, there you go. Things are going good. Glad to be in the show, and hopefully you won't swear or say anything too bad.
Yeah, good. So do you want to just tell us a little bit about yourself or what you do day to day?
Yeah. I'm a traditional telephone engineer. I work with sort of legacy telephone systems, and over the last few years I've progressed more into the network side. Gone down the route of doing the Cisco CTNA, starting to really get involved in the network side, and now started to work with some Juniper kit as well. Some of the more traditional IT side of things like email and all the rest, I'm not just as familiar with. So that's why I thought I would pick your brain for free instead of paying somebody else to.
So have you been doing much of the JunOS stuff with the Juniper kit,
just been starting to learn that, which is very, very different when you've just come through the Cisco track.
Yeah.
The Juniper operating system is very powerful, but very different in context. You know, when you're used to working on sort of Cisco and, you know, you do your show run and you're looking at your configuration, which is a sort of flat configuration file.
It's got loads of brackets in it, hasn't it?
It's like an indented programming language.
Yeah. And they say that you can use it as all, they use it over the firewalls as well, don't they? It's like they've gone to the whole Combazel kind of thing, haven't they, for firewall and switches there.
Yeah. Well, what they say is, you know, compared to Cisco, which is, you know, Cisco of many different flavors of iOS, you know, if you're running, you know, like routers or switches, it's iOS. If you're running like a Cisco ASA, it's a modified version of iOS, and the syntax is quite different. But with Junos, it's one unified operating system, which actually runs on top of BSD.
Well, I didn't know that.
So, Yeah, it's BSD based, so you've got that solid platform of BSD, and then Junos runs on top of it.
Yeah.
And one of the things that Junos or Juniper sort of claim as one of their benefits is that the operating system is exactly the same whether you're running it as a switch, a router, or a firewall.
Mm-hmm.
So unlike, you know, Cisco or whatever, you know, where you have to jump around from, you know, different command structures and different layouts, you know, from ASA to you know, iOS, or in the data center, is it, there's a higher version in the data center switches. It's a different version of iOS anyway for sort of data center switches, the Nexus range, Nexus 7000, Nexus 5000.
Yeah.
So at least they've got that one operating system, which obviously leads to consistency and familiarity. You know, so it's good. It's just very different to Cisco.
I've been using those net screens. I've always used net screen firewalls for about 10 years now. And
I was going to say those net screens are old. I don't think they're Junos, are they?
No, they're not. They're not Junos. They're their own. Now they're called Junipers. They're like the NX series now. We haven't purchased anything new because the new company I currently work for doesn't use them. We're a Cisco house. Or that's not. I can't think of what the other ones we use. But we normally put in like a Cisco ASA if we need to put anything in. So.
Yeah, the Juniper kit's nice, and one of the things about it, it's not as expensive as Cisco, and they're making real pushes into markets that Cisco would have been thoroughly embedded in, and they're making the options an awful lot cheaper. So it's been interesting. I've worked on quite a few devices. I've set up a couple of the EX switches. I've set up some of the SRX firewalls, which very, very basic configuration, but some of the smaller SRX firewalls. Yeah. And then the company that I work for, the entire core network. It's sort of not a strange company that I work for, but the company that I work for does an awful lot of various things. Traditionally, telephone company, but yeah, they're actually an ISP as well.
Right, okay.
So the core network that provides the sort of ISP and private networks and is now actually in the process of being converted to an MPLS network. So we're going through the process over the last 6-8 months of changing out our core from Cisco to Juniper. Mm-hmm. So there's a consultancy firm that we deal with that they're actually doing most of the work, but we are assisting them with a lot of the physicals and a lot of the... So it's interesting. It's something that I have to get my Juniper JNCIA before Christmas.
All right, okay.
So I've got my head sort of writing that at the minute of sort of trying to figure out.
Are they sending you on courses, or are they, have you got to do like CBT nuggets or anything? We've got to read books, or?
We have access to CBT nuggets. We do have training days, but currently at the minute our training days, I have some objectives in work where I actually have to use my training days for Mitel, which is a major brand of telephone systems. They're a big sort of voice over IP provider. Big in the hospital space and big in the sort of large enterprise. So I'm using my training days for Mitel stuff at the minute. And in the evenings and the weekends, I'm sort of trying to get my head into doing self-study. So Juniper has a lot of really good, they realize there's a lot of people, they're trying to attract people from CCNA level across to Juniper. They've made like fast track plans, so you're supposed to be able to, if you're familiar and experienced with Cisco, they try and make a fast track available so that you can progress to the Junos. But because I'm sort of CCNA level, probably slightly in some ways more experienced than CCNA, but in other ways maybe just haven't had the hands-on or exposure, there's things that they maybe assume that you know. Where I'm going through and reading, it's interesting because I like the way that the fast track, that you don't have to sort of start right from the beginning. You can do the equivalency transfer, of sort of they know that you're not coming from, in a lot of cases, that you're not coming from no experience. You're coming from a Cisco background and you want to transition your knowledge that you currently know to Cisco to Juniper, and it's really getting your head around, the differences of, instead of running, constantly running, show interface status or show IP interface brief, what's your equivalent, which is, show interface is terse or,
Well, I've been working, because we're an HP Gold partner, we sell all the HP A and E series switches, and it's different terms between the two. So you got the E series switches, which are basically the original HP switches. And you've got the A series switches, which is the old Freecom. Not who's the other, who did Freecom take over? I can't think what they're called. You get like the trunking. So in Cisco world, a trunk is what they class as having multiple VLANs on one port, isn't it?
That's right, yeah.
But
the way it, and I'm just actually starting to learn this as well now, because I'm sort of used to configuring trunk ports and access ports on Cisco. The Cisco way seems to be so much easier. We're doing, if you want to set up a trunk port, it's literally switch port mode trunk, and then in the more, the older ones, you used to have to set your encapsulation between whether it's ISL or .1Q or whatever. But the way that you set it up in other vendors like Zixel, some people call it Zixel or Zixel or whatever, but the way you set up in Zixel or the way you set up on Juniper is actually very different. You're creating like a tag port, and then you set your tags, which is just totally different, because to me the Cisco way of doing trunks and access ports is so easy. You want to put a port in an access port, which I'm sure people think we're just rambling on if they don't know what we're talking about. But, you know, if you're putting a port in an access port, you're really just putting it in a VLAN.
Yeah.
Whereas a trunk port, which is really, you know, links between switches, carries every VLAN. Yeah,
H3C's the people hard to think of. Basically, H3C port, Freecom, then HP, sorry, H3C port, Freecom, then HP port, so you get the three different things. So, like, if you're, like you're saying, if you're talking about trunking in Cisco world, you're talking about a port and adding multiple VLANs onto it or whatever. And then, but trunking in HP world is about trunking is putting two switches together and having two trunk ports so you can get more bandwidth through. And like that, like Ether channel in Cisco.
Like
world.
Like a port channel or, yeah.
But it's quite good because that's the document, what's HP coming, it shows you what the three different commands are for the three different things.
Yeah, it's funny, and some people pick up this really easily, but I'm actually finding it really hard. Most of the other engineers that I work with are, from a network point of view, an awful lot more experienced than me, and they work with other vendors, you know, other systems like Zixel. But really, from a network point of view, I've only ever done really small business switches that are literally no management or Cisco. So one of the things I'm finding hard to get my head around is how you set up like an access port and a certain VLAN or a trunk port on the Juniper, because it's totally different. You know, when I go to set up a trunk port or an access port, all I'm thinking is, you know, switch port mode access, you know, switch port mode trunk, you know, and you know, obviously you've got all the bells and whistles that you can put on after that. But in Cisco, it's actually really easy to set, you know, a port in a VLAN or a port in a trunk. On the Juniper, you know, you have to go in, you have to, there's two different ways you can do it. And what ultimately ends up happening to me is I remember the first part of the command of doing it one way and the second command of doing it the other way. And I get confused as to how to do it. But, you know, most of the other guys, because they're used to working with Zixel and some of the other brands, that seems to be very close to the way of doing it, you know, where they set up the ports. And then it's almost the opposite. You tag it to what, you know, if you want it to be a trunk port, you tag it and then you tag it. You set it as a tag port, and you allow the you tag it in what VLANs you want it to be a part of, and then if you want it to be an access port, you untag it, but you tell it what VLAN it's in. To me, it's just totally different. It just seems totally backwards compared to Cisco. But
yeah, so you were talking about that you've got a client or something who's got some email you want to convert to maybe Office 365.
Yeah. This was the sort of crux of what I wanted to talk to you about. Yeah, small business, sort of traditional type business, and what they currently have is four or five users that are on a POP3 setup. Now they're a little bit of a sort of hodgepodge of a small business, but what they currently have for the email is POP3, and they have got a mixture of Outlook Express and Thunderbird as the email clients, and what I'm looking at as a larger part of a project, just to give you the sort of bigger picture, they're currently on XP machines, and they're on a peer-to-peer network.
Yeah.
Their files are absolutely all over the place. The parts that I'm comfortable with and which we've already agreed to do, they're going to be buying new Windows 7 machines.
Yeah.
Windows 7 Professional. And it's actually quite good with Dell. They actually come with the upgrade rights to Windows 8 as well. We're going to be transitioning that across. So that's going to be their workstations. They're too small for a domain or for a server. So what we're going to be providing is a Synology NAS with around 9 terabytes of storage. I'm going to be putting in a small unmanaged gigabit switch, and then we're going to have them move all their files across to the Synology. We're going to be creating the accounts and all the rest. I actually look after one or two other customers that have Synologies as well, so sort of relatively familiar with them. But the part that I'm unfamiliar with is the transition from POP3 email, where we want to move to something hosted, and give them, you know, the ability to, they don't have email in any, you know, they've no remote email. They literally just look at their email on their email client, give them email on their smartphones, and give them access from home, and try and make, you know, bring their business into the somewhere near the 21st century instead of running Outlook Express.
Yeah, okay. So Office 365 sounds the best way to do it. I mean, that's the only people I ever really. I've used a couple of people in the past, but Office 365 seems to be the best way to go because two ways, it's their product. They know how it runs, and there's so much documentation online. If you get a problem, you can Google it, and someone else has already had the issue, kind of thing. So, and the good thing about it as well that if you the different plans is that if you have one of the plans, I think it's when you get the right basic one, and you get the second one up, you everyone gets a copy of Office 365 of the latest version of Office. So.
I was looking at that. So when they get their new PCs, instead of having to go and buy Office Suite,
Yeah. The
they'll
problem
be
you've
able
got is
to.
that you also at Office 365, if you just buy the Exchange Online part, so like the £3 a month one, you have to make sure you've got, if they want to use Outlook, they have to have a recent version. So like they tell you what they have. So like I think it's on like Office 2007 or 2010, but they've got to be at a certain service pack for it to work. And I don't think Office 365 now supports Windows XP either. So
Gotcha.
what Yeah, so the good thing about having Office 365 and paying that money, you're always going to have the most recent version of Office. And if they decide that they're going to release a new version of Office, you get that version of Office. So
Yeah,
that's.
which is also that's a win for the customer as well. So instead of buying, Office 2013 9, I think there's a new version due out in 2015.
So Office 365 Small Business Premium is £8 a user per month. So, and you get the full Office. Apparently, you can install the Office onto up to five PCs that each app. So you have to have. So you wouldn't be able to do it, but you could have it. They could have it on their work PC, and then at home, and then on another PC, and then they can even have it on their tablet or whatever, on their smartphone as well.
I did a bit of research and I sort of looked into all of that as well. One of the questions I had, but I did speak to a guy that sort of does a little bit of work with email. I was wondering, could we cheap out and buy one version of the Small Business Premium at £8 a month, and then for the other three users go for the £3 per month, and then try and install the desktop version of the client on the four other machines.
I don't think you can, because what you do is you buy into the plan and then you can only buy those kind of licenses. So you go in there and then you buy it and then you say, right, I can, you have to buy five of those licenses. You can't say, right, I want one of these one license and then three of the other licenses, if you see.
Right, gotcha. So if we've got four users and they are going to be getting new PCs, what we actually have is four users. And then the generic admin at companyabc.com. So
You don't need a license for that.
yeah, that's just going to be, I imagine, a distribution group or
Yeah,
that sort of thing, right?
you can have distribution groups are free, and you can have a thing called a resource mailbox. Okay, so if you wanted to have an admin mailbox or like a sales mailbox where everyone get access to, they are free. Now they've got a limit on how much space you can have. I can't remember off the top of my head, but it can't be someone's primary email account. It has to be a resource mailbox. They
Right, okay.
need
So
them if you like, so.
that would actually be perfect because what they actually have is admin at company ABC. Literally, they have, admin at companyabc.com. So we could set that up and then everybody would have access to that, yeah? So perfect, because I thought the admin at abc.com would be like a distribution group. So we could actually set that up as the shared mailbox for them. Yeah,
Yeah,
that
that
sounds
definitely
ideal.
works with the I'm guessing it must work. They must be able to name. I'm guessing if you Google it, we could have a look. But that's the way it works in the next version up. So you get Office 365 Small Business, and you get the, I can't remember what the next name is, but like it's like up a past 25 users one. But we can have a look into that later. But the way I see it transitioning it, and the way I would, which is how I would go about it, is if you've got access to the DNS records.
Yeah, that's something we're in the process of sorting. So at the minute, what they have is they're paying a company that's in the same country. I'm based in Northern Ireland, if you can't tell by the accent. They're paying a company that's not local, but they are based in Northern Ireland, and they're actually doing their website hosting, and they're doing the POP3 email. So what we're currently going through at the minute is trying to get access to the DNS or the whoever the registrar is. We're getting access to the control panel.
Yeah.
And I think what you're probably going to talk about next is so that we can get access to the records so that we can change the MX records to point towards their fixed IP of their – or no, it won't actually be their fixed IP. Sorry, I'm getting totally confused. It'll actually point to the MX records that Microsoft will provide.
Yeah.
So we'll be able to forward the MX records to Microsoft, yeah?
Yeah. So what you do is when you create your Office 365 address, you have to pick a name which is like you would have it. So it'd be company.abc.onmicrosoft.com, and that's what you start off with. And from there, what happens then is that you can log in with that site. And the first thing you do is you have to set up DNS, and it will basically guide you through setting all the records up. So one of the things is you want to set the MX5 records up, but I don't recommend doing that until the last bit. So it will say, right, you have to create a load of A names and stuff. Because what happens is that when you go and go, because when you want to go and check your mail, let's say you want to go to OWA, you can go to Office 365 online, and it will ask you for your email and username. So you put your email address in, and it will go off and do something in the background. It goes, oh yeah, well, I know you're so and so at companyambc.com, and go and enter your log you into the right portal. That also means is like with Office 365 is when you install Office 365, sorry, Office 2013 on the actual customer's PC, it will ask to auto set up your Exchange server. So the first thing it'll say, it'll ask you for what your user email address is. And using auto discovery, it will look at the end part of your username. So the email address. So it'll look at office or company.abc.com. In the background, it will go and check the MX records, and it will basically point to Office 365. And that will know how to log you in. Do you understand that one, saying?
Yeah, okay. And because, I mean, I'm familiar. The company that I used to work for, which is a small business, worked for them a couple of years ago. I had full access to the control panel. And what we would do is, in that case, we would send the MX records and a few, like, we would have a few services that we would run. So it would be like remote.companyabc.com and then email.companyabc.com, which would go to our public IP address of our on-site services. And then the hosting was done by a hosting company, and then the A records would go off to the IP address of the hosting company. So I'm familiar with how you would split, send your MX records one way and how you would send your A records another way, and then coming up with things like C names and that sort of stuff in the control panel.
Yeah. So like here it says you do a change, you've got to create a couple of things. You've got to do a change name so that on your D records so that basically it changes to autodiscovery.outlook.com, which basically when you auto configure Exchange, that's how it knows how to get back to Outlook.com to configure Exchange. Okay. You've got to accept an SPF record, is basically for spam filtering. So that's good. So then what I would do is once I've created those, I'd leave the MX record to the last bit, okay? I would then go and create the user accounts how you want them set up, okay? So you go in there, create the four users you want. You can put as many aliases you want in there and get it working how you want it to work, okay? Then I'd get each of the users to go to the OWA site, the Office 365 OWA site, get the users to log on and test that they can send emails through each other, make sure they're happy with the how everything works, okay?
Yep.
And then what I would do is that if before you put the brand new PCs in, on each of the old PCs, I'd give them the web link so they can go to OWA. On the Friday, go, right, from now on, if you want to send any new emails, send them from your OWA address, okay? And at that point, you change the MX5 record so that all new emails get pointed to Office 365. So over the weekend, all new emails will come into the Office 365 emails, okay? And maybe if there's some of the DNS propagation, all the old emails go through into the their Outlook Express, Outlook or whatever, okay?
Yep.
And tell them if you need to reply to an email, just create a new email in the OWA, and then OWA's Outlook web base. So it's basically like Outlook, but it's in a web browser, okay?
Yeah, yeah, and it's got so much better than it used to be. Yeah, it's
OWA really 2013. It's literally like working in Outlook 2013.
Yeah, just one quick question: is OWA and RWW the same thing, or is OWA the new iteration of RWW?
No, OWA is just the Outlook at web access to get into Exchange. Okay, RWW is a part of SBS, which is a remote web workplace.
Yep.
So you'd use that in the old Office. Sorry. SBS 2011 was a portal you could go to and you could access your emails, or you could access your desktop, or if you had a terminal server you could go into that and then you could access it, or you could access your files.
Yeah, that makes sense, because the company that I used to work for, where I did some of the administration, they actually had RWW, so that's the difference between RWW. Yep. And OWA. Okay, yep. That's good
and
to know.
Then I would then go around and then give the people the new Windows 7 machines, pre-configured with Outlook. So when you install Office, it will basically, there's two ways of doing it. With Office 365, you have to go to a website, click on download, and it downloads like a little file, and then you run that, and then it goes off to the web, and it then obviously downloads the files.
Mm-hmm.
But obviously, if you want to do that four times, you're downloading a gig's worth of data at a time. So what you can do is that you can, there's Office 36, Office, there's a utility which you can, I can't remember off the top of my head, but I'll put it in the show notes. So you can run a command and it downloads the files for you and puts it in on, you can put it onto a USB stick. And there's another command you can then run which says deploy it, and then it will then install Office 2013 on that PC, okay?
Right, gotcha. Because that's probably one of the biggest areas where I have the most questions is, how do you actually transition? You know, if you've got the user, I thought my thought process is that so that they will have, because they're moving not only from one type of email to another email.
Yep.
This is a very clean solution where they're actually going to a brand new PC as well.
Yep.
So I wasn't too sure if we'd do something like an archive all, yep, of their email to a PST, and then do you upload the PST to the portal?
So what I would recommend you do is that, bit of a tip, is that when you start Office 2013, it asks you to sign in with that username and password, okay? Because basically you have to activate it with that username and password, and obviously that's how it gets over the 5 limit, so that's why you can install it 5 times. You have to run, the first time you run an application, run as administrator. If you don't, so if you right-click on Word or Outlook, say run as administrator, and then it'll pop up and it'll say put the username and password in, their email address and their password, boom, it will activate. If you don't run administrator, you'll get an error, okay?
Right, okay. So elevated privileges, yeah.
Yep. Right, I would then go into Outlook and then reconfigure it, and when it will then say, right, what sort of email account do you want to set up, and you can say like an email online, put the email address in your password, auto-configure, boom, they've got Office 365. So all the emails that I've been sending in through OWA will all be started to be downloaded and everything, okay?
Okay, and what about their old emails that they've
right.
had?
So,
their hoarded, saved emails that they've been archived.
So, what you need to do then is, the Outlook ones are going to be nice and easy. You can export their files into a PST, okay? So file, export into a PST. If they haven't got Exchange, you might actually be able to, if you write, because they're not running Exchange at the moment, in Outlook, if you go to properties of the, you know, at the top where like it says that email and like Office 2000, Outlook 2007 at the top, it's got like a little icon at the top. You can right click and go to properties and it will tell you how big the data file is. Do you
yes.
know what I'm talking about?
Yeah, don't want to spoil what you're going to say, but I guess where you're going is because they're not actually running Exchange server at the minute, they currently already have PST files.
Yeah.
Is that where you're going? Yeah.
Mm-hmm.
Okay.
So just go there, go properties, find out where it is, and then all you need to do is copy that PST file onto their new machine, And in Outlook 2000, you just go file, import. It's not the most obvious places. I can't remember it is off the top of it. It's not like in. Is it not easy to find?
It's different in 2013, yeah, because I actually run 2013 at the minute, and I know exactly where that option is.
So
yeah.
Go file, import, and then import the mail. You're probably going to get is how you import Outlook Express and Thunderbird. You probably have to do a bit of Google search on that, but I'm guessing you'd be able to find on that. Because I know that you can. You might have to go a bit of a long way to do it. Because I know you can import Outlook Express into Outlook. So, and then obviously once you've done that on the old machine, maybe you could then copy the PST file and then move it. Or you might be able to copy the Outlook Express files from the old machine onto the new machine and then import them into Outlook Express. And then you might be able to, from the Outlook, import it. So, but there must be ways. We can't be the first people to come across this.
No, and I've heard Thunderbird's actually quite good as well, I believe, for as a transitionary method. But what I can do is if it comes to it, what I can do is actually set up a virtual machine, and then put on like a trial version of Office and do some temporary. So what I would like to do is come that Friday, where I would actually have all of the PSTs pretty much ready to go over the weekend.
Yeah.
And then just upload them. So I'll figure out the little intermediary version of or the intermediate thing of what I have to do, so that hopefully come, maybe not the Friday night, but over the weekend, I would do the hard work of transitioning, so that over that weekend we would have four PST files that we can upload to the portal. Yeah. And then once you would upload those to the portal, I'm guessing then whatever you put up to the portal shows up in their, when they move to their new system, everything that you've exported from your PST then just shows up in their history, yeah?
Yeah, you do it through their Outlook. So on the new PCs, on the new Windows 7 machines, or you just go into Outlook and go file import.
Ah, right, assuming that you do it in sort of cloud portal. Okay.
You literally do file import. With good thing about Office 365, what happens is, you might want to change this, but it tells you how much data is stored locally. So it normally is 12 months. So normally I put that to the full amount, to like forever. And what you do is you import it in the local and it puts it into the OST file. Okay.
Right.
And then so, in the background, it then trickles it all up to the internet.
Right. So just for my own curiosity, I say I'm not an email guy, but I do know the difference between an OST and a PST. So when they're actually running Exchange 365, will they have OST as opposed to PST, because they're actually running Exchange, yeah?
Yeah. All OST means is there's an offline folder for Exchange. That's all it means, is that when you go into Exchange, if you didn't have an OST file, all your emails will be there. But if your internet connection goes down, you won't have any access to your emails. So with an OST file or an offline folder, you would download all your emails locally onto the machine. If you use internet connection, or you want to take your laptop on the train or something with no 3G connection or anything, or Wi-Fi connection, you can still have access to your emails, your old emails. You won't get new ones until you're online. But you could then go online, create your emails when you're on a train. When you get to your destination, you connect to a Wi-Fi, your internet comes back up, boom, those emails will go again.
Yeah, and then they'll send. And the other thing that I like about the options of going for Office 365 is that if your customer, instead of having an on-premise Exchange server or whatever, if they have a power failure or an internet outage or whatever, you can still actually go elsewhere. Your email is not affected, and then you can log in and work from the portal, OWA portal. Because in the past, on a number of sites that I've been involved with, if the customer has a power failure or whatever, and they're not paying an intermediate company to to filter their Exchange or to filter their email, and they're on site, either the internet goes out or the power goes out, they're losing their emails. I know there's services that you can have buffer when your IP is not online, or when your connection's not available, because some of those services like Pastini and some of these other ones, they'll actually filter your emails for spam, but they'll also offer them as well for 48 hours.
I used to use Pastini, but I now use a company called PostLayer. So basically an MX backup. So you basically forward all your emails to them, they do all the spam checking, and if your internet goes down, they store it, and when it comes back up again, they then push it through to you.
Yeah.
With Office 365, you do get that spam filtering as well. So they got their own spam filtering software.
Okay. So, I mean, in this scenario, I mean, we've pretty much decided that we're going to go for Office 365, but have you ever done a bake-off between sort of Office 365 and Google Apps for Business?
Yeah, I really haven't done much with Google Apps. I mean, I know a couple of businesses use it, kind of thing. And I know that you get them free if you're a school, aren't you, and stuff.
So yeah, yeah.
Sure, I haven't really done much with it, I'm afraid, so...
Yeah, I have one for I sort of had a little part-time consultancy business on the side, and I signed up for an account sort of 3-4 years ago, and I was grandfathered into having the free account. But yeah. I mean, literally, all I have it for is sort of, you know, I've got one email address running on it, which is literally help@mydomain.com sort of thing. You know, it's literally just, it's not even a sort of personal account. But yeah, I mean, it's pretty good. And I know you get all the benefits of the, you know, the Google Drive and the Google Docs and all the rest. But I mean, I'm not sure for a business that's, you know, where they want to live.
No, I'm a bit worried that once, I mean, you got that Microsoft's got your data, but at least you know that if you want to get your data out, you can, kind of thing. You can just export it to PST and then you can go somewhere else. When you start getting it into Google, then it's a bit harder to get it out again, isn't it?
Because Yeah. It's funny. I was listening to something today on the way home, and it actually made me think of a question as well. There's currently a court case going on at the minute where there's a guy I'm not sure of the backstory, but he's an American living in Ireland.
Right.
And he's using... There's some files or some service that's on a Microsoft server, but the Microsoft server is in Dublin.
Yeah.
And the US government are trying to extradite the information, but, you know, the Irish government are saying no. And it actually led me to think of this question is, with Exchange 365, where are your files and your mail actually hosted? Because obviously where that Exchange server is hosted can drastically affect the jurisdiction of who can look at those emails or who can subpoena information or who can request access to that.
It's a bit of a grey area, really, where it is, because you don't know where it is because you can't specify where it's going.
That's right, okay. So there's no guarantee that because you're based in the UK or Ireland or whatever that it's going to be based. Because
I'm guessing it's probably in Ireland because... I think it when you set it up, I think it knows kind of where you're when you sign up, you have to put your email address and your postcode, your address in. So I think it kind of puts it where you are, but I don't think you can choose where it is. That's the only one thing about Office 365 is you don't know where your data is.
Yeah, because there's so many laws. You know, basically what that thing was, really the reason why I mentioned it, because I could have given better examples of just saying, okay, I want my stuff to be in, you know, UK, Ireland, whatever. But the point is that, you know, in that case, that's an American living in Ireland. Microsoft are trying to extradite the information off the server. But because the server is based in Ireland, Microsoft in the US can't actually subpoena that information because the information is, you know, even though it's an American, doesn't matter, it could be an Irish person, the information is on a server that resides, you know, full-time in Ireland, so the American government can't subpoena that information or request information for that. And in certain businesses, you know, that could be quite a consideration of...
Yeah, we have a number of our customers at my work who are like financial, and they're not allowed to have their data sitting outside the UK shores, so... For that kind of thing, you have to kind of go to a company in the UK. I mean, we host a couple of customers' servers in our data center who provide the virtual means, but they know their data is sitting in the UK and it's not going to go offshore. But I mean, that's what I guess you have to lay the pros and cons up. I mean, it is quite cheap going for Office 365, isn't it?
Compared to trying to host it in your own data center or whatever.
Or you choose a UK company who's doing it, so.
Yeah. Is there, just out of curiosity, it might be a question that other people will be thinking of as well, what would these days be the difference between hosted Exchange and Office 365?
what the differences are, kind of thing.
Yeah, because I mean, hosted exchange is still a term that's out there quite a lot. Is hosted exchange really you're paying another company, like, you know, I don't know, like 1&1 or GoDaddy or whatever, to, you know, to have that exchange server in their data center? And then
so you got, there's three different types. So you've got on-prem, which means you've got you've got Exchange 2030 is sitting on your local server, but again, you have to pay for that. So you have to pay for your, so you have to pay for your hardware, your software, so your Windows licenses, and then you have to pay for your Exchange server. Then you still have to pay for your cows, for the people connect to it, and for the storage, your internet connection to get the data in, your spam filtering. So that's like 6, 17 you've got to think about. What happens, unless you're doing like a software agreement, software assurance with Microsoft, when Exchange 2015, whatever next comes out, you're going to have to purchase the new licenses again. So that's one of the reasons why people go for these Office 365. Well, you know what your monthly outgoing is. With hosted Exchange, so what you're getting is you've got someone like GoDaddy or someone like that, or ShareWeb, who are basically, they are hosting their own Exchange, their own Windows servers with their Exchange servers on, where you're on there, that you're like a little customer on their big Exchange organization. And then you've got Office 365, which is Exchange 2000 in the cloud, but it's their own kind of, they've basically customized and written different bits so that they, it runs a lot smoother, basically.
Right,
that
gotcha.
Kind of explain it a bit better?
Yeah, it does, because I think they've made Office 365 so cheap that, you know, for a lot of small, medium businesses, it's not even worth considering going to like a third party, you know, for hosted Exchange. And certainly, I'm guessing there's probably a break point at maybe, I don't know, 30, 40, 50, 60 users, where it obviously starts to make sense to do on-premise, but for small businesses, 4 or 5
Well, no, not really, because I know some big customers who are going to Office 365.
Really?
Yes, because of the you think about how much data you can get. With Office 365, how much data you can get, it's something silly. I can't remember it. I'm going to Google it quickly.
25 or 50 gig, isn't it? Per mailbox.
And you think how much, if you've got to pay tiered storage to have that, and if you've got 100 users or whatever, it's, and you then got to buy enterprise cows because you want to do things like link online, because when you get onto the bigger, you can get link and stuff involved with it as well, like the E3 plan. It works out, because with the other thing with Office 365 is that you get things like, you get the OneDrive and stuff, so that if they want to, they can store it, the documents on there, and then when they go on their devices, like their iPad and stuff, they can obviously get, they can get that, they can get that, they can get there, they can have access to their documents, if you see what I mean.
Yeah, and it also includes the SharePoint and Link as well, doesn't it?
Yes. So Link is a bit like Skype, but for businesses, so you can kind of talk to each other.
Yes, the grown-up version of Skype, isn't it?
Yeah.
And yeah, I mean, to be fair, this is sort of, not to take it back to the almost the start of the conversation, but services like Link, is why, like, an old-time traditional telephone engineer like me is trying to transition into networks, because, you know, Link's going to make my type of job go away. You know, if I didn't start to transition into networks and IT a few years ago, you know, old dinosaur telephone engineers like me are going to, you know, be out of jobs quite soon, you know, because Link is becoming so popular. And again, that's part of the scary thing for me, is that Link now being integrated into something like Office 365, it puts it into the reachability of, you know, £8 a month, you know, compared to, you know, so you could buy, you could have like a 10 user office, or, you know, a 20 or 50 user office, where you're effectively getting your full office suite, you're getting your email, and you're getting your Link client, and you're not paying any upfront costs at all.
Yeah.
You know, it's quite scary for an old dinosaur telephone engineer like me.
Cool. Is there anything else you want to ask about it, or anything else?
No, I think that's pretty much covered off everything that I was thinking. Just out of curiosity, I was talking about what they're going to do for their transition from the peer-to-peer network, and I'm going to be providing them with this Synology NAS. Mm-hmm. Have you ever done any work with NAS devices? Or
normally we put in a server, really. We don't normally do that. Normally it's that small enough business. We know 10 users plus kind of things. So.
Yeah.
But Synology boxes are very good for that kind of thing. They're brilliant. Especially if you can do it so you can sync it off-site. It would be brilliant for them, so...
Yeah, that's going to be one of the other considerations is how we're actually going to get the I'm trying to follow the 3-2-1 backup rule. You know, where it selects three different copies, two different medias, one offsite. What I have with the current Synology that I look after is the gentleman has he's invested quite heavily in his business and he's got a LAN VPN between his office and his home.
Yeah.
Between two Draytech routers. Mm-hmm. And he actually bought a second Synology for his home, and we push it back up every night at 6 o'clock. Whereas for this business, they've no real interest in doing like a VPN, a permanent VPN, a LAN VPN to somewhere offsite. So we're going to have to figure out a way of doing an offsite backup.
Yeah.
So what I'm actually thinking is doing a Linux box somewhere, and doing an rsync push, because the Synology, the one that I currently look after, does a Synology software sort of backup and transfer and does all the deduplication, but within the backup properties of the Synology, you can actually do an rsync as well. So you can actually push an rsync off to a Linux box. So we might do that. I might have to figure out a way of sort of port forward.
I really love the rsync. I haven't used it before until about 3 weeks ago, and it's brilliant. I've got all my PCs now using rsync to...
Even Windows PCs, yeah?
I haven't done with my Windows PCs. I haven't got any Windows PCs at home. So I've done my Linux boxes and my Mac boxes. So.
Are you all Linux or Mac OS X at home, yeah?
Yeah, well, I've got... The only Windows box I've got now is my media PC, which has got a dual tuner card in it, and that basically does my recording the TV stuff. And that's got Plex on it, so that it can speak back to my Plex server.
Oh, that's another conversation. That's a conversation for another day. I'm a massive Plex fan.
Yeah. I've got my Linux box, which is basically my home PC, which is I'm doing all my stuff on, which is my PC I use. And then my missus has got a Linux iMac to do a design work on. So okay. I don't have any Windows boxes except my media PC. I've always got a Windows box for work, but I haven't got a need to... use rsync on Windows. Can you use it on Windows at all? Or
Yeah, there's a way you can do it through... there's a way of doing it. I must actually look it out. There's a little client that you can add on that does it all in all-in-one installer. Yeah. But have you ever heard of Cygwin?
Yes.
You can install Cygwin, Cygwin.
Yeah.
And that gives you a lot of the sort of, so if you're, instead of, you know, if you prefer the Linux sort of way of doing things, like, you know, you can actually have full, nearly all the full Linux commands within the Windows operating system. I've only ever installed it once. Generally, what I tend to do is I like to run Linux boxes myself, but on my work laptop, I have a VirtualBox and VMware workstation, and then I generally just run my sort of a lot of them Linux boxes in VMware player or in VirtualBox. But yeah, I mean, it's do you think there's do you think it's beneficial to know Linux, and it's beneficial to know, you know, things like, I mean, comparing, you know, to me. I tried to learn as much as I can in my spare time about the Linux CLI and living the terminal. And to me, it's actually it's quite fascinating that it's almost come full circle now with Microsoft, where Microsoft are pushing so much towards PowerShell.
Yeah,
and to me, PowerShell is just Bash for Windows.
Yeah. Well, PowerShell now in Windows is they say that they write it in PowerShell first and then they put a GUI on top. And that's why a lot of things you can only do through PowerShell now on a server.
Yeah, and, you know, I know a lot of the modern versions of Server. I think, you know, at Windows Server 2012 R2, there's the option to install, you know, the basic non-GUI version, but you can also install the GUI version as well. But I believe from the next versions of Server, There's going to be no option to run the GUI version. It's going to be, you know, the what is it called, the minimal version or
core version,
the core version. I believe one of the next versions of the Windows Server operating system is going to be core only, which I don't know when that'll actually come.
See that being the case, but everyone likes a clean and push. I'm a very when I'm trying to fix a problem, click. Where am I going to see where what settings I can change or whatever? So
yeah. Some of those PowerShell commands can get really long, and you know, to be fair, if you're googling for an answer and you have to drop the PowerShell and you're essentially just copying and pasting a command, you know, this long random string of text that you're pasting in and you're hoping is going to work. I've never met anybody that is I know a couple of hardcore Linux admin guys, you know, and they are the traditional, you know, grey beards, beards out here and all the rest, and they really know their stuff. They know Bash, they know Script, and they know Python, they know Perl, but I've never met an out-and-out PowerShell admin, you know. It's like there's a lot of people do things in PowerShell.
Yeah, but I've got one friend who just lives in PowerShell.
And you've got seriously? Mm-hmm. Seriously? I say you have a much wider IT circle than I do.
Yeah. So Linux stuff, I just play with it. I don't know that much about it. Well, I basically dropped into it. I mean, I've done play with Linux for. I got well when I first got a job really in IT was with one of the other companies up with an ISP, and the guys just showed me Slackware, and I could not get my head around that. Everything I did wrong. If I was anyone, I couldn't work it out. Before you could Google stuff, you'd have to basically reboot the machine and reinstall it again. And I really haven't done much of it until like a year ago, when I started listening to podcasts. And it was basically regarding the crypto locker virus. I go, well, I don't want to get caught by this. I'm gonna move to Linux now. I'm gonna listen to all the podcasts and stuff. And then I got a couple of CentOS boxes we have to look after work, and that's kind of dropped me into it. I know still really not that good on it, but I've got more of a idea about it. I just find it really scary coming from Windows going to Linux. It's just knowing what you're used to. It's like it's like the file system where it's like everything's under one kind of root partition, isn't it? And getting your head around that and the user accounts and SSH.
But it actually makes more sense when you stop and think about it. It actually makes more sense that it's a flat file system. You know, you've no registry hacks. You've no emulated. You know, registry things that you need to do. You know, even your processor is, you know, it's effectively a flat file system that identifies your processor, you know, as a cat / proc or whatever it is.
Something like that.
But everything is it's a flat file system. When you learn Linux, and I class myself as a Linux hobbyist.
Yes, me too. I'm nowhere near that way yet. So.
I love to tinker, but I mean, it is amazing where there's so many things now in my work, you know, a lot of the VoIP platforms, a lot of the router platforms, a lot of these things, there's so many of them are based in Linux. There's so many of them are based in BSD. I mean, we were talking about it earlier.
Yeah, I'd like to get someone on the show, really, to talk about how to troubleshoot Linux servers, because that's the only problem. When something goes wrong, I don't know where to start. I know you can look in like /bash logs and start going tail and stuff and the file log name. It's just, I don't know, you can stop and start like the services, whatever they call it, Linux or whatever. I just want to see if I can get someone on at some point.
Yeah, demons. Yeah, that would be a show. I'd be first up to listen to that one, because there's a real. I'm just talking about my personal experience. There's real divide, and this is why I earn the side of caution and call myself a Linux hobbyist. I'm probably slightly more than a Linux hobbyist. I know more than just a noob, but I it's very difficult to get to that from between the noob to knowing what you're doing. You know. Say I'm probably a little bit more than a noob, but what I would like to do, I've set myself a couple of projects, and I've started the projects two or three times, and I just get incredibly frustrated with it and then give up. And what I would like to do is I would like to set up a postfix email server.
Yeah.
And I say I've started it a couple of times, and I just end up giving up. I'd like to set up. It's very easy to install like a Squid or SquidGuard. As a pre-compiled download package, but to actually install something like Squid, which is a proxy server from scratch.
Yeah.
Building a LAMP server's pretty easy. It's not that bad. I've done that in CentOS. I've done that in Ubuntu server. It's fairly straightforward. You've got a lot of tools. I don't mind. You know, there's a couple of times I've had to do things in sort of servers where have you ever heard of Webmin?
Mm-hmm.
Where you can install like the Webmin front end, but I mean the Linux graybeards and neckbeards really frown on you for using things like.
Yeah, well, I started using that when I first Linux, but I don't use it at all now because I so like using the command line. I'd rather just do it properly, if you know what I mean.
Yeah. But I mean, you've got tools like that available. But I guess my point is, it's difficult to transition from that. You've just got beyond the stage of being a noob, but having enough time and living in Linux enough to be able to say, yeah, I know that. I feel comfortable doing that. I could go for a Linux job. You know.
Yeah. I still haven't found anyone where you could really go to ask if you've got a problem. That's the problem where I find the main thing is where you go to ask if you have a problem.
Yeah. And then you do. I mean, there's some people out there, and especially like the arts community, that sort of thing. You get the old RTFM.
Yeah, that was I was exactly thinking about it. No, if you.
I think we all know what RTFM stands for.
Yeah, and it's annoying. So okay, well, brilliant talking to you, mate.
Yeah,
hope you got everything you wanted to get out of it, kind of thing. So
yeah, and when it all doesn't work, I'll just phone you, and you'll have to remote on it there for me.
on about our help. So. Right, speak soon.
All right, thanks very much. Talk to you later.
Well, thanks to Al and Al for that great interview there, all about Office 365 and various other topics as well, telephone systems, etc. So thanks to Al for that. And, of course, in the future, we may have other guests on the show. So that would be great as well. So don't forget, though, you can still get in touch with myself or Al at andy@admin.co.uk or al@admin.co.uk. You can subscribe to the feed on Feedburner, subscribe to us on iTunes, or download the show directly from the website. So with that, I hope you enjoyed the show, and we'll see you next time.